Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee. We have Cannondale and Trainer Road's Amber Pierce with us today. How you doing, Amber?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here. Hi, everyone.
Hey, we have Cliff Bar Racing and Trainer Road's Pete Morris.
Hello, everybody.
And we have our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
We are going to answer more of the questions you submitted at trainerroad.com/podcast. You can do that every week, by the way. And I love seeing the questions that you send in. Please continue to do that. We'll go through and pick some of the great ones that you've sent in to be able to address them on the podcast every week. Quick little note, we've had some fantastic successful athletes podcasts lately, and we're going to have some great ones coming up. So you can subscribe to that podcast at the link down below, as well as the Science of Getting Faster podcast. And you can do that as well at a link below. I should figure out how to talk if we're going to record a podcast right now. Talking's tough right now.
John, if you want someone like a comeback story, you could use me in the future.
This is actually why you've done this whole thing.
Yeah, I just looked at my 4 weeks like average hours on Strava. 1 hour per week for the last 4 weeks. So my training is literally like 10% of what it was, which is crazy. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Workouts are hard.
Life happens.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is why Nate did this, just so that we could have a great successful athletes podcast episode. It's entirely designed for it. So you should check it out. Fantastic episodes. You just talked with a teacher that did a high school math teacher who hero alone for that. And then she did a double Ironman. She's amazing. We talked to the youngest athlete we've had on the successful athletes podcast, 16-year-old.
High school math. That is, that's patience.
Can you imagine?
Yes. There's probably some AP class where it's, I don't know, but me in high school math, but she, formal geometry at Reno High. Oh. Amber probably aced that class, but she goes, yep, I did. You did. She's laughing. That's why you went to Stanford. But yeah, it's really hard. I mean, to do that.
Such an impressive person.
I can't even describe.
And she just got up super early to get her training in because she couldn't, you know, with teachers, they have a really long day that takes up the day, right? Like it takes up the whole time, and keeping up on nutrition throughout the day was also tough for her. But she shares like the tips that she did, because teachers can't take a bathroom break in the middle of the day. So like you can't just like overly hydrate, you know, it's complex. Like it was a really great podcast. And we just
Let them pee?
Well, no, like she can't just be like, hey, like between classes, it's fun. But she can't be like, hey, students, hang out for a while. I'm going to go to the bathroom. That's, you know, they have to be there in the class with the kids. I remember mine doing it too, but I think that she's just really responsible and awesome. So we interviewed a 16-year-old who is at 5.6 watts per kilogram. So like 330 watt FTP. And then he's 130 pounds from Texas. And he has gone through Nika, and we talked all about like what racing in Nika is like and what training is like in Nika versus now he's racing in the elite, so the Pro Cat 1 field.
Yeah.
It was cool to talk about the differences and how the races shake out, how he's had to adjust. Anyways, really cool stuff, and we have great episodes coming up. I want to leak about them, but you never know if like a recording will fall through, so I won't say it yet. but fantastic ones. And if you want to be on that, there's also a link down below for you to submit your story about how Train Roads help make you faster. Nate, an adaptive training update we should share, because there's been quite a lot of progress this week.
Yes, we have 1,550 people now in it, and we're adding, I just checked, unless there's a critical bug today, an extra 400. So that's the, like I said before, the pace is coming up a lot more about getting people in. And as long as there's no additional bugs, the pace will increase and increase and increase.
It's awesome. Super exciting.
But we're sorry you're not in yet.
Yeah. We wish we could let everybody in, but we're that's why we're ramping it up. But we're also ramping it up because we're making progress, right? So
working really hard.
You know what I should do?
Really hard
behind
the scenes, guys.
Yeah.
As I'm saying something really stupid. Amber's like, we're all working very hard. And I'm gonna say something really stupid. What I should do is say, and that, you know, whoever, for all the people who follow me, in the next week, five of those people will get on adaptive training, because then you would have like
giving away a lot.
It's like a giveaway.
Follow Nate on Instagram. Tr.Nate.
That's not true. That's not true. There's a plan, and I don't even know.
This is my time to get you back for that.
That's okay. I don't even know how to add people to adaptive training beta, so I'm not the person.
Yeah, Either am I. So
we're keeping that person's identity closely guarded.
Yes.
It's the red door. It all happens behind that red door.
Yep. It slips up under.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Let's go into Sabrina's question. She says, I know I can't be the first one to submit this, and you are not alone in this, Sabrina. In fact, just this week, I was telling Amber, we got like many requests for this, so you are definitely not alone. She said, so I'm just going to upvote all the others that have been submitted. I want a special podcast all about Amber's pregnancy as a cyclist. What has she learned? What's been hard? What was she expecting would be hard that wasn't hard? How was training adapted? What has she learned about training changes needed during various trimesters? Has there been a mental shift from identifying as a cyclist to now identifying as a cycling mom? For many of us, the greatest fear of pregnancy is how it will affect our training. So let's hear what to expect from the now pro-pregnant lady. And she says, P.S., you're pro at being pregnant. I love that. That's awesome. She says, P.S., thanks for everything you guys do. Obviously, I'm a female and a huge Amber fan, but even before Amber, I thought you guys did a great job of addressing females in the sport and being upfront saying, I'm not a girl, but here's what the science says. So thanks for being inclusive of all of us all of the time. And actually, I just want to echo that. There was a racer who came up to my wife and actually expressed the same thing this weekend at a bike race, and that they appreciated that. And that's just, that makes us feel really good. She also gushed about how awesome Amber is, and we agree. Aww, so
that's very sweet. Thanks.
Thanks to everybody that said hi during the race this weekend, by the way. There were a lot of people that I saw, and race analysis coming soon. But Amber, let's talk about this. This won't be like maybe we'll do a full podcast episode in the future on this, but yeah. Where do you want to take this? There's a lot to cover.
So I guess I can start with just the basic question of what I've been doing. and it's not a lot of training. I mean, I've been doing a lot of things, but not a lot of riding bikes and lots of learning. So like what my training, and I'm using air quotes here, looks like right now is I'm doing daily walks. So I'm taking the dog out for a walk every day, which has been really nice for a lot of reasons. Mental health being one of near the top. Just getting out. We have a nice little loop on a trail through some open space in the woods behind our house, which is really nice. So I get out at least once a day to do daily walks. And one of the interesting changes that's taken place is I've shifted mindset from many, many, many years of having dedicated workout time. Like I have to have a scheduled workout where I go and I work out. And now what's happening is I get up on a little 5-10 minute break from work and throw a kettlebell around or do some bicep curls or do some squats or do some stretches. And so it's not like a dedicated block of time where I'm doing a workout. It's more like I'm kind of doing things throughout the day as it fits and feels good. And that's been really interesting because it's been like, oh, you can do that? That's allowed?
It doesn't have to be a structured big hour and a half block.
Yeah. So that's been really interesting and fun because you still make gains and you notice progress, but it's such a different mental approach, and it's been really nice. It's been kind of freeing, like, oh, there's different ways of approaching this. And then what's been really cool is I've learned, I'm working with a doula who's basically a pregnancy coach, and I highly recommend this if anybody, is pregnant or planning to get pregnant. A doula is a wonderful resource, and she's teaching me all kinds of cool stuff. And the uterus, by the way, is a muscle. So she has shown me all of these cool things I can do to stretch the muscle, to identify which, you know, if I'm feeling discomfort, which tendons might be shortening. So showing me stretches for uterus tendons, which who knew?
Yeah. So cool. Like, that's cool.
I'm learning.
Wow.
I really thought I knew my body until now. And I'm like, wow, there's all this cool stuff I had no idea about. So I'm spending a lot of time being really fascinated too. You can imagine is really fun. Different trimesters. That's a good question. And it's so individual. It's so different for everyone. Cause everyone I've talked to who's gone through this has had vastly, vastly different experiences. In general, kind of the big broad brush, you know, generalizations are the first trimester, you're really, really fatigue is high. It goes through the roof. A lot of women experience nausea, known as morning sickness, but most people I've talked to, it's not restricted to the morning, and it certainly wasn't for me. It was constant.
Yeah.
The only good thing about that bike racing really taught me was after bike races, I'd get really nauseated, but I learned and I was able to train myself to eat anyway because the eating actually helped. And in my case, with the nausea in the first trimester, eating did help. So I got really good at kind of getting past the nausea. You know, the nausea makes you not want to eat, but that was kind of like, okay, no, I know I've been here. I know if I eat a little bit, it's going to help. And so, you know, staggering like smaller snacks throughout the day to sort of alleviate that. And I did not, for me, it wasn't so bad that I was vomiting. And some women really experience nausea that's so severe that they actually have to, you know, seek medication so that they can actually get and keep food down, which is really important at that time too. So I was lucky in that regard. And then second trimester has been more of that bounce back of the energy level. And my belly feels really big, but it's not as big as it's going to get yet. So it's this nice balance where your energy level pops up. And mechanically on the bike, things aren't so unwieldy that you can actually still ride it. And I'm actually carrying a little bit high, I think. So that helps a little bit on the bike. Some people have asked me how it's been riding a bike, and it's been okay because I think that helps a little bit with the hip angle. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't been too bad. But I think, so a few things that I've learned, ventilation threshold, that's the biggie. That was the very first thing I noticed was I would get so winded just going upstairs or just on my walks. It was wild. But what happens is, the developing baby is it's pulling so much oxygen from your body. And so in order to compensate for that, the pregnancy hormones automatically shift your ventilatory thresholds. So you start breathing really hard at a much lower level of effort in order to provide that extra oxygen, you know, for both systems, so to speak. And that's been, so it's kind of, I was so glad that I learned that because it made me, at first I was like, wow, I'm really unfit, but it's no longer correlating with fitness. It's correlating with this new, bigger demand for oxygen that your body's experiencing. So that's pretty cool. And that's been persistent.
That's sounds like altitude training.
Yes.
I know, right? Yeah.
Seriously.
That's what you're laughing at, Pete. It sounds like.
Yeah.
That's a really good analogy.
Because it's more like there's just less volume in you, right? Yeah, so as a result, your lungs cannot take up that space because baby's there.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. The lungs are getting squished and squished.
Yeah.
And then the cool thing about that, though, is on the bike, strangely, I feel really good on the bike. I feel almost more comfortable on the bike than walking around now. I have not been using a power meter because I don't want to worry about it. I've been riding on feel, but I feel pretty good. And the other thing that happens is your hematocrit goes way up because you have that extra demand for oxygen. So that's probably offsetting a little bit in terms of the ventilation threshold and, you know, power to weight, God knows what that is right now. Like, I don't need to know.
You got to figure out the baby's FTP first, actually. And then you can actually. We don't
There's
do that.
A whole new, whole new equation we can bring in. Yeah, so it's been really fun, like learning all of these little quirks of physiology, and the doula's been an amazing resource. One of the funny things I experienced early on was when I first got pregnant and I was talking to the nurse at my doctor's office, one of the pieces of advice that she imparted was that I shouldn't allow my heart rate to go over 140. And I thought that was really interesting because as we've talked about on this podcast, heart rate is a very, very individual thing. And I'm thinking, she didn't give it to me as a percentage of max. She didn't even
like, do you know who I am, doctor? Yeah.
So it got me digging, and it was kind of the first foray into that, okay, I'm going to go do my own research, as you guys can imagine that I do. And one of the things about this process has been really interesting, and I think it's hopefully a takeaway for anybody, even folks who are not pregnant, which is to take kind of this economist approach to the research and the statistics, because oh my gosh, do they throw statistics at you. Okay, well, we have this thing and now you have a such and such percent likelihood of this thing. And no one has a crystal ball. There's no way to tell the future. So you're dealing with all of these probabilities all of the time. And it can be really, really overwhelming. And one of the things that economists do is they will look at data and they will look at probabilities. And you don't jump from data and numbers and probabilities to conclusions, actions, or plans. There's a step in between, which is values and preferences. So, okay, you can have 10 different people looking at the same numbers or the same probabilities or statistics. And each of those people is going to have a different set of values and preferences. So they are each, according to those values and preferences, going to feel very differently about that same set of numbers and statistics. And based on that, they're probably going to make different decisions about what they want to do. And that's been a really interesting process. And that's something that we all do here at Trainer Road too. And with our training plans, you know, we look at a study, it gives you some data, and then how you go ahead and apply that, you know, that data in your own life or your own training has to filter through that contextual component of, like, you know, what are my goals? What are my values? What are my preferences in my life? And that might be schedule constraints. That might be your event goals. And then based on those things, how do you want to apply this data in terms of decision-making and actually making a plan or executing a plan? And so this has been a really good exercise on that, because we get opportunities to do that cycle of thinking and decision-making over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But that's been a really interesting kind of fun learning as well. So yeah, that's a little bit of a takeaway. But
how about on clearly it's your first time through pregnancy, and yes. and as we've mentioned many times before, I'm a dude. I have no clue how any of this stuff works. So, with that said, has sport helped you in unique ways with pregnancy? Because this has been like, so I would call myself a bike racer, but I'm not like, and Amber, her entire life has been an athlete, right? So like, that's like your identity. You've had a relationship with sport for a really long time. So how has that helped you? Or even that identity question that she asks, is that tough too?
Yeah. This is great. Cause, I think the assumption is that being in sport or being somebody who's fit and highly trained would confer a lot of physiological benefits. And it does in many ways. But I think the two most important ways that sport has helped me has, like, on accident and not intentionally, helped prepare me for this process have really not a lot to do with the physical, you know, the physicality of being fit and prepared for this. And one of those is I've learned to deal with the loss of fitness a lot over my career, which is a funny thing to say as somebody who is a professional athlete, but I've been injured a lot. I've been sick a lot. And I've gone through this process of having something happen where I can't train. So all of that hard-earned fitness starts going away, which is terrifying because it takes so much work to get that fitness.
Pete and Nate are just nodding. Yeah, we're just
nodding. We agree. Tell us how it's okay.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So the more times you go through that process, the more frequently you go through that process, the more you start to stack up these experiences in your past where you say, hey, I've been here before. It's familiar. And the last time I was in this place, I actually got through it and was able to come back again. And so I don't want this to come. I'm not equating pregnancy to injury or illness. It's absolutely not. And it's kind of funny. It's one of the wonderful perspectives of the doula is she's always there to ground me in that this is a natural process for your body. It is not a medical condition. So that's a nice reminder. But so it's not a medical condition or an injury, but there's an analogy there where there's this letting go of that hard-earned fitness. And I feel so much more comfortable with doing that now because I've been here before. I've been in the position of needing to let go of the fitness. And I've come out the other side of it and gain that fitness back. I've reclaimed it, I've built back, and it's been okay. And so I don't feel that same fear that I did early on in my career where I was faced with a situation where I was having to let go of that fitness, you know, often not by choice. And that fear of, am I ever going to get it back? How long is it going to take to get back? And now I know, hey, my body's been here before. It knows what to do. If I just allow this process to happen, allow some patience, allow myself some patience and some grace, it's going to come back. And so that piece has been really nice because that's brought a lot of peace of mind through those experiences and that familiarity of being in this place. And the other thing about that I'll say is the scary part about losing fitness is how hard we know it, how much work and how hard it is to gain it in the first place. And that's the scary part of losing it.
It's making you feel better, Nate.
I'm tuning it out.
But the thing to remember is the process is actually fun. Yes, it's a lot of work, but oh my gosh, how fun is it when you start to see those gains, right? Mm-hmm. And when you are early on in that process of coming back, those gains come fast and they're big, huge gains. And it is so motivating. And it's easy to forget that the process is the fun part, right? Engaging with the process. And so reframing that a little bit can help of, okay, I'm not just losing this thing that's going to be really, really hard to get back. It's, hey, I get another opportunity to go through this process, which is incredibly and deeply fulfilling. Mm. So that's one framing on it. The other piece you mentioned was the identity piece. And that's another letting go. And that's another thing that I've had to do a lot through my career in sports. So the first time going through that was with swimming, and that was so hard. It was so hard. And yet I found cycling, and, you know, I felt in that initial moving away from swimming that I had lost this identity of being an athlete. And then I came back around and reclaimed it as a cyclist. And what I've learned through sport and through many, many years of this, so this is a lesson that was a long time coming. This is not something that was easy to pick up on and learn and internalize. But I feel like I've gotten to a place now where I'm familiar with that loss of identity, that transition of identity, that change of identity. And so having more of a fluid identity feels familiar and safe now, that I can let go of this identity of someone who can get a QOM on every training ride. I can let that go because I know that I can reclaim it in the future if I want to, right? And I don't have to reclaim it in the future. There's no obligation to that. And that I'm open to adopting new identities and different identities. And that now feels safe because I've done it many, many times over the years and been okay. So those are two kind of interesting and unexpected ways that cycling and sport have actually prepared me for this experience in ways that have nothing to do with fitness, strength, numbers. It's really two big things that are hard to let go of, and realizing that it is okay to let go.
Mm. Yeah. This is awesome. I feel like we have really, we're pretty lucky these days to have great examples of women who are mothers who are managing their relationship with sport out in the open, like Lizzie Deignan, Catherine Pendrell, Sonia Looney, like these athletes that in cycling who have become mothers, and then they're taking all different paths through. I mean, Catherine Pendrell, she just almost topped 20 to World Cup, and her I don't even know if her baby is 6 months old. Like, it's just incredible what she's doing. And the cool part is it's nice to just see everybody sharing whatever their path is through it, because it's all unique, like you said.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd want to share on this, Amber?
The last thing that's been kind of a pleasant surprise, and not something I've really, it's something that's only kind of come to the surface of my awareness in this process. And that's, I'm really embracing sort of the more feminine associated physical characteristics in a new way. And this is what I mean by that. So As most of you know, I started swimming pretty seriously by the age of 10. So I've been really deep into sport for a long time. And in sport, we are generally striving for what we would kind of culturally associate as masculine characteristics, right? We want more muscle, more definition, you know, kind of angular muscled physiology. And, you know,
when does that happen? That'd be nice.
It is one of those things that's it's harder, I think, for women athletes. And it's not just something that, oh, you go through puberty and now your body's changed and it's all done. For women, there's this really kind of long transition where, yeah, you go through puberty, but then up into your upper teens and even early 20s, your body is still changing substantially, and it's rounder and it's softer. And maybe there's not as much definition as, you know, the same guys that you used to be competing or training with in high school. And that's a really tough transition for a lot of athletes, and especially athletes who are competing at the collegiate level. That's sort of when a lot of that is happening. And it's a really fundamental change, and it requires adaptation in how you're training and how you see yourself. And that's a really tough, That's a lot to handle at that age when you're also handling, you know, being new to college and being new to other things. So, I think that, and add to that, that when you're in sport, those very characteristics, the roundness, the softness, the curves, those are all of the things that coaches are telling you are not good. Like, you don't want those things. And, it's one of the many ways that it doesn't always feel safe to be a woman in sport. It's a very, you know, even in women's sports, it's a male dominated space, amazingly. And this has been such an interesting experience because I'm working with, you know, women providers and talking with other women who've gone through this experience, which is so unique to those feminine characteristics. And it's been so fun to completely embrace this. Wow, my body is just, it's getting really round. and it's okay to feel round, and it's okay to feel soft, and it's okay to embrace these feminine characteristics that for so long and so many years of my life, it felt like were the wrong characteristics, you know, the things that we didn't want, the things that I was trying to avoid. And it's amazing, and it's really, really nice. I don't know. It's just an interesting observation that it's really clear to me now, looking back, especially being pregnant now and in this very kind of, you know, specific situation, to reflect back on that and how that was an interesting and pervasive part of the journey.
Mm. These are awesome points. Thank you, Amber, for sharing these. Nate, do you feel more consoled about your road back to fitness at all?
I had some, I felt it when she was talking about getting rounder and softer.
Strong that connection.
Is strong connection.
Grace your feminine side, Nate.
That happens too.
Should we move into Felicity's question, Nate?
Yes, but I want to just hijack for a second. You know what? And with my hour training per week, Pete, right now you and Chad will beat Sophia and I with the amount of my speed right now. Unless I don't know where Chad's at, actually. Do you know where your partner's at for Cape Epic?
I can't give you a numerical value for Chad right now. So that means I hope it's pretty good.
I don't know. Nate, did you leave a trainer with him when you locked him in the basement?
Oh, yeah. We didn't mention this, Jonathan. Sophia qualified for the Olympics.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Oh,
yes.
That's right. Sorry, I have an Olympian really partner.
And I train 1 hour per week. She's going to yell so much. I know, but she's the Argentine. They have one person qualify?
Only one athlete.
And it's the and first time in forever.
Yeah, her and one other Argentine athlete. And my goodness, Daniela, I believe is your name, but I could be wrong. They worked really hard to get points, racing all around the world, paying their way to some events to be able to get these UCI points that they need to be able to send a person to the Olympics. And it's the first time in almost 20 years that Argentina has had a female mountain biker go, and she's going. I just think that's so. For those that don't know, I'm going to record a Successful Athletes podcast with Sophia on this because I just think it's so incredible. 4 or 5 years ago, Sophia thought, I guess I'm going to give this bike racing thing a proper shot. Like she was like, and her coach was like, do you want to go to the Olympics? And it was kind of like, sure. I mean, I guess why not? Crazy moonshot. Let's go for it.
Yeah.
I just think that's so cool. Like, and really admirable. She is such a cool athlete and inspiring and just awesome. So everybody should go follow Sophia on Instagram because she shares a lot of fun content there and insights into her life. And please go let her know how awesome the thing that she's doing is, the qualifying for the Olympics and inspiring a whole entire generation of athletes. It's so cool. So congratulations, Sophia. And congratulations, Nate. For having that partner.
Oh, yeah.
Congratulations, partner.
I did a lot. Yeah. No, it's actually, it's slightly intimidating even more. I mean, she didn't get any faster, but it's just like, whoa, it's serious, right? I'm in awe of Sophia. So that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Felicity's question. Are we ready for that?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. She says, love the podcast. I've just been getting into it. I started racing last year and I'm on a team. Congratulations, Felicity, being on a team so fast. She says, I ride about 150 to 250 miles a week, usually shorter 15 to 30 mile rides on weekdays with longer rides on weekends. lately I've been trying to make more time for 110 to 135 mile rides of about 6 to 10,000 feet of climbing. That's really long. Those are big days.
Those are huge days.
Yeah. And I'm on the road for 10 to 12 hours during these rides. So she's taking this pace. She's not like going crazy race pace with this stuff. She's just putting in time, right? She says, I really try to eat a lot of food during these rides, which kudos to you, Felicity. She says, I stop at least once on this ride and eat some solid savory food like a veggie sandwich or burrito, but I'm mostly fueling myself with things like goo chews, energy power bars, and carb and electrolyte drink. Eating a lot, and she mentions in parentheses here, more than I used to eat on long rides, has made me feel way better, and I feel super strong during the rides. But each time I do one of these extra long, about 200 kilometer rides, my stomach feels a little nasty and I feel slightly nauseous the day after. Is there something I should be doing or eating more or less of on the day of the ride to help avoid this? So first things first, we should probably mention this awesome blog post that we have. It's called Long Solo Rides and Tips for Epic Days in the Saddle. It's a fantastic post where you can get lots of stuff from it. And Jesse, one of our awesome copywriters, put that together. There's tips from Amber about what she liked to do on long rides. Cause oh, heaven knows Amber's had a lot of long rides in her career. Yeah. But Amber, what would you say to this one? Do we want to talk about big rides first and then go into nutrition, or how do you want to handle it?
So I'm curious, because I'm curious about what kind of racing you're doing. Those are really long rides. Those are really, really big rides. And I'll just share, I mean, racing a full World Cup World Tour schedule, I almost never did rides that long in my training. So I'm curious if you're training for really, really big events that are really, you know, maybe ultra distance events where that might be necessary. But even then, you don't necessarily need to be doing that kind of mileage every weekend. And I don't know. So I don't want to, I just want to say this for the sake of other people who are listening. I don't want to question, you know, what you're doing, but I think that even if you're training for a really big long event like that, a jump from 15 to 30 mile rides to up to like a 200K ride on the weekend, that's a really big jump. And it's not going to be that kind of distance is really only helpful for a very small subset of types of events. Even when I was training for a 200 mile gravel race, I trained mostly between 2 and 4 hour rides until there was a gradual buildup closer to the event. And the event day was looking at 11 to 12 hours in the saddle. And the longest ride I ever did was 10 hours. And I did a really gradual buildup from 4 to 6 to 8 to 10. And I only did a handful of rides that were between 8 and 10 hours long. Those big rides, they will leave you feeling nasty almost no matter what. And there's so much that your physiology needs to adapt to that you really need to build up to those distances over time. And that might be a big part of it. It might be less to do with what you're eating and whether or not you've built up to that distance gradually enough to allow your physiology to really catch up and adapt. I don't know. I see Pete nodding. So I want to hear what you're thinking, Pete.
Yeah, this is pretty funny. So I went to Moab this last weekend to ride some mountain bikes, and a couple of my teammates were doing a gravel race called Colorado to Utah. It might be like CO2UT, and it was 190 miles, I think. And since I was only an hour and a half away, I swung by to say hi. But they we had a beer and had some dinner, but they were all kind of laying out their nutrition or gathering their nutrition the night before. And so it's really funny, Felicity, we kind of tackled all these questions in one go with three of us standing around.
Should have recorded it, Pete.
I know. And actually Connor said, are you going to record this for the podcast? And I said, ha ha. And here I am. So Connor, you won this round. So one of the kind of the three things I was trying to get into their head is that it's really about intensity and duration, and then making sure the foods play nicely with your body. And there's a kind of a perfection and then what you're actually going to be able to do. Right. So when you have three facets, like kind of all vying for attention with this kind of long ride scenario, I think it's really important to consider intensity right at the beginning. because intensity just makes your GI system not work as well. There's not enough blood. There's not enough energy. There's everything that requires your stomach to really work. You've taken away from it. So if you are kind of on the lower intensity end of the spectrum, you kind of have more freedom to play with your food. But again, it's still how nicely do the multiple foods you're eating at the beginning play together. So for some people, they can eat a Clif Bar and blocks and electrolyte drink all at once. And some people's stomach really don't agree with that. And again, it's practice and kind of figuring out what your body likes and what it's able to do. But generally speaking, you can kind of go more solid food at the beginning when the intensity is a little lower, and always erring on the side of focusing more on kind of more well-balanced meals, I guess I would call it, at the beginning, while your stomach's still capable. Because kind of as you get a few hours in, your stomach starts not functioning at the same capacity. So one of the things that I was thinking for Felicity is make sure you're stopping for that sandwich or burrito kind of early. Like I would say only 2 or 3 or 4 hours into the ride, because you're never going to feel great even after. If you're riding for 10 hours, unfortunately, you're not going to feel great the next day. And forcing your butt for it's like handcuffing your stomach and then putting a bunch of things that it's not really dialed to eat for 10 hours. But I do think you can fix some of the nausea and like the overall feeling of uneasiness, by paying attention to timing your food correctly with intensity. So more well-balanced meals early on with lower intensity, and then you kind of lean into the more carbohydrate rich, easier to stomach foods at the end of the ride. But again, try to pay attention to how specifically you feel, whether you're eating goo chews or electrolyte mix or a carb heavy like Martin. Something's just going to feel better with your body, and then you can kind of lean on that later in the ride, and you'll end up feeling better by the end of the ride and the better the next day. But if you're just riding for 10 hours, it's a lot of calories to make your stomach go through to make this happen. One of the things I was telling the guys when they were getting ready, actually, they did pretty well. I should give them a shout out. I think everybody got in the top 10. I think they got third, fourth, sixth, and eighth or something. But for a bunch of crit racers, well, not so bad for a,
not
for
too
a,
bad. Yeah.
For a 10-hour gravel race. but I had them kind of pull out each hour of what the race would be like. So they had eight-ish hours of food. And we broke down the first couple hours as the race was probably going to be fast, and you're probably going to be able to eat less, even though you want to be able to kind of put the more macro-heavy food at the beginning. So I said lean heavily on breakfast, and everybody should eat a way bigger breakfast than they think they should, because you probably won't eat for the first 2 hours of this race while it's kind of shaking down. And then they could like lean in, and so they had it all broken down. So they had hour two, three, four, where they knew what they could stomach. There's a lot of fruit ropes, like fruit leathers, things like that, where there was something easier to eat but still calorie dense. And then we did measure out the carbs, because it just makes sense. If you give someone the option to eat 100 grams of carbs an hour because you're on a 10-hour ride, you're going to feel so much better the whole time. And so that way they had, here's four things to eat during hour three to four. And you know, if you don't eat all four of them, you're under fueling. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel worse later on. So I think that having kind of check boxes where I'm going to try to eat all of this food from three hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, and you try to do the best you can, and then you can kind of taper off a little bit more. So by the end of the ride, you're actually not putting a bunch in your stomach. I mean, you're putting less because you've fueled properly the whole way. And that will also give your stomach a little bit of a break for the 10 hours of the riding.
Nate, I have some thoughts on this, but I want to hear your thoughts first.
I disagree with what Pete says. Anyway, entirely. Okay. So on the longer rides, what I find is that at the beginning, you can do a lot of gels and stuff, and it's not so bad, but you get palate fatigue. And that is when I crave, this is not a race, right? And this kind of thing. That's when I crave that solid food. And if it's a 10 or 12 hour, totally do the solid food. But I would not do things like a veggie sandwich. To me, that's a recipe for slow digesting food that's going to be in there. Have you guys ever had like food poisoning and you throw up vegetables like from like 14 hours before or something? Yeah. And you're like, how is that still in there? Like, I hate that such a long time ago. Just trust me on this. That's what happens. And but I wouldn't do a burrito either.
Don't
but
ask
also
for
high
detail.
Fiber. Yeah. Anything high fiber, I would stay away from. And what you're craving is probably fat. And for the savory, fat, probably some protein and carbohydrates. So things like potato chips, French fries. I would even do like little McDonald's hamburgers without the cheese, stuff like that. That's because that's that palate fatigue with savory that you want, and you want a lot of calories. And then as you're getting lighter, you're in a caloric deficit, right? Or not, you're in a carb deficit as you're going through this whole race. I highly doubt you're going to be on top of it the whole time with nutrition. So even as you're getting further and further into it at the end, you got to keep up still eating in order for recovery for the after that ride. Like, you may be able to finish without it, but you'll just feel a lot better if you keep doing it. So I wouldn't, even if you said, hey, I only have an hour left, I can make it home.
Oh, no.
On a 10, 12 hour ride, just keep going. Cause it's going to, this is going to be like another like 12 hour process that's going to go through in order to recover from this. And you'll probably absorb it a little bit better too, as you're riding. I think those are the main things. Burritos. I don't like the burritos because of the beans in it. People can have tough digesting that. And I guess if you did it with white rice and white rice meat, like, and salsa too, that can be hard. Anything spicy. And so one thing that gets you is anything acidic. That's another reason why I say something like a McDonald's hamburger or something with tomatoes, or like, think about drinking orange juice like 6 hours into your ride. Tomatoes are kind of like that, right? With
my
salsa.
My throat just caught on fire.
Yeah. I know. I wouldn't do any of that. So that's another one, a peanut butter and like a peanut butter and honey sandwich or something. That's a great one with white bread. That's savory, easy to digest, has some fat in it, portable. You can carry it around.
Rice cakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So this is, Felicity, first of all, you're very brave. I would never eat like a burrito or a veggie sandwich mid ride, because I would be terrified of what my gut would do to me thereafter. This is why I almost force myself to just take in my carbs through drink mix and gels, and that's it, because I view it from a risk perspective. What's the risk of taking in something that isn't so concentrated, that isn't just on the carb spectrum, doesn't have anything else? If I take in a burrito, or there's countless things that could go wrong with my stomach thereafter. And then that could make it so that I get a really bad night's sleep. And then that makes it so that the next workout isn't very good. And then it cascades. So for me, I look at this like, I want to put the most concentrated thing possible in terms of what I can take in for carbohydrate into my bottles or in my gel, that sort of thing. Or in other words, like the most focused, the least variety. When I'm off the bike, give me as much variety as I can possibly have. When I'm on the bike, keep it as simple as possible. Fast burning carbs, and I want to train my body to be able to take that in. I've seen this situation where a lot of athletes say, you do that long ride, you stopped, you had a burrito, and then you keep riding and you're like, oh, my stomach hurts. And some experienced person on the ride is going to be like, it's all those gels, you know, they give you gut rot. And it's like, hey, you also just put a giant burrito in your stomach. So like, you know, like, it's not just the gels. You can get used to anything more or less. It's impressive what your body can tolerate. But if you can get to the point where you're just taking in like race gas, so to speak, you know, like just that stuff that really focuses on making you faster, I think there's a huge benefit to it. Because it's pretty easy to take in a lot of calories through a bottle when you have like a high concentrated mix, like 90 grams per hour of like glucose and fructose. And with gels, you can get in quite a lot of calories with that. It's portable. It's something that you can have on race day. It's something that you know that it's giving you what you actually need on the bike, which is at that point, it's really the sugar that you need, the fast burning sugar. So I, you know, not all food is created equal in terms of energy availability on a bike, and not all carbohydrates are even created equal in terms of energy availability on the bike. So it's really a decision of what do you want to do? Are you trying to do these rides and train your body for race day? If so, then you should eat like race day. If not, then, and if it's for the social experience of being able to stop mid-ride, then it's just knowing what you're going to be dealing with. And then making sure that you aren't, you know, piling on more complexity on top of whatever you're eating mid-ride.
Yeah.
So people think I'm weird because I just drink all of my calories and maybe take in a few gels. But I'm like, it seems weird not to do that because this is just like, so like it fail proof in air quotes here. In other words, it's like, so there's just a lot less risk with it.
Yeah. One thing to think about in terms of, you know, we talk about upset GI systems or digestion as kind of like a whole, but there's a couple of different components that are affected by your exercise. One is gastric emptying. So if you think about your stomach, it works almost like a colander. So when you take in fluid and solids, the solids are going to sit and the fluids are going to flow out of your stomach pretty easily, or more easily and quicker than will the solids. And so the solids having some gummy bears, right, is going to, those are going to sit not quite as long in that colander as would say a sandwich, right? So, and the solid piece that's in the colander is what's called a bolus. And that's the difference. Like when you actually chew some solid food and you swallow a bolus and then that sits in the stomach. So the length of time that the bolus stays in your stomach depends on what it's made of. And so like Nate was saying, fiber is slow to digest. So there are certain things that are going to sit longer in your stomach. But then the second half of this process is all happening in your gut, right? So in your intestines. And this goes back to what Pete was saying about how the intensity of the exercise is really going to affect this too. Because when you exercise at really high intensity, say at race pace, which is going to be hard to do over these really, really long distances. But if you're racing a 200-mile gravel race, that's definitely happening this summer. So a lot of people are going to be doing this. You're going to be experiencing, you're going to be racing at very, very high intensity over the course of that 200 miles. And one of the things that happens at high intensity is it affects the degree to which your intestines can actually move food through the intestinal tract. So when you swallow, you're using musculature that does what's called peristalsis. So it's kind of squeezing the food along so that it can move through the tube of your esophagus. And the same thing happens in your intestines. And that peristaltic motion can be affected and either become weaker or actually disengage for temporarily when you're really putting out a huge, huge effort. So there's kind of two ways that you can feel that discomfort. You know, one is at that stage in your stomach, and then you can also have that shift in how well things are moving through and absorbing in your intestines as well. And both of those things can either make or break a day for sure.
Ain't that the truth?
So figuring out what works for you, you know, depending. So again, context, what works for your body under normal circumstances, how intense are you actually, you know, what level of intensity are you hitting on these rides? At what point in the rides are you hitting intensity? Can you shift around the types of fuel that you're taking in based on that intensity? And then carry those lessons over from the shorter rides that you're doing, the stuff that you know sits well, the stuff that you know is easy to get down. And keeping in mind, you know, maybe some points you might want to stick with fluid calories because it's going to come through that colander really fast versus other times when you're going to really need something solid in your stomach to feel satiated, especially in some of these longer rides too. So unfortunately, it's going to be a little bit of trial and error, but I think a really important thing to keep in mind is your body needs time to adapt. So if you're going to try something new, you're going to need to give it some time before you know if it really works for you. It's just, it's a little bit frustrating, but once you do figure it out, it'll be really, really worth it.
I want to add one disclaimer.
Please go.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, actually, Amber hit on the last thing that I wanted to talk about is there's different types of discomfort. Mm-hmm. And so paying attention to that, whether it's gut discomfort or you feel like you're, everything's not moving through you at a correct pace is super important. And then the second thing is I totally agree with John and Nate. I think if you're feeling like your performance is being limited in any way by your calorie intake, it's much more important to focus on the intake itself. If you're debilitated by nausea and the way you're feeling the next day, then I would swing back over and start thinking about things not necessarily from the fueling perspective and try to figure out what the discomfort is. Like you have to figure out the problem first before piling more on top. Just it's two different approaches. And a lot of people find something that works really well for them, like John, and can just do it forever. And it's totally fine. But it takes a lot of people a long time to figure out what jives in their system. And one of the things you can do is you can do a 6-hour ride and you can figure out kind of just as much. And then you don't feel quite as badly.
Yes.
after all, you know, day after day after day, weekend after weekend. So try some things during a 5 or 6 hour ride instead of during your 10 or 12 hour ride, and you'll be able to get that kind of iteration will happen faster, and you can make better decisions without kind of laying it all out there and being like, well, that didn't work at all, and I feel 10 times worse than I did last Saturday.
Yeah.
So yeah, play with everything and pay attention to how you're feeling, and do it during slightly smaller rides, and you'll get there for sure.
Yeah.
Nate, did you have anything else to add?
Just that, Felicity, it's really like if you're racing that distance. So if you're racing that distance, I really like the idea of trying to go John's aspect. And that's what I do too, is just pure liquid on racing, because it's very convenient and it's nice. But if you're not racing, it's just for fun. I know there, it's a lot cheaper, and it's also like less, it's just more fun to eat like food during it. I remember the first time I did the, one of my first rides, I did the Carson loop here, which is like a 56 mile loop. And I stopped in Carson City and had a whole pizza. It was like, it was so hard.
I love that.
That's awesome.
And it was fine. And you know what it is? I do. If I could not do that today or any time in my career, well, I was raising. If I was
illustrious,
no, exactly. In my free time of riding a bike, if the intensity was high, no way. But if the intensity's low and you can talk the whole time and stuff, I could totally eat a pizza. I could, you know, stop for 30 minutes, eat a pizza, get back on the bike and go. And mm-hmm. I think we've all experienced this on like coffee shop rides where you stop, mm-hmm. you eat a bunch of food, then you get going with your friends. You drink even like coffee, which is very acidic and could be hard on the stomach, and you're just okay. And it's just as everyone says, we're beating a dead horse here, but it's the intensity, the purpose, what your performance is and all of that. But I remember, Leadville, even Ironmans, you actually don't really want to eat that night very much and the next day, because you're so messed up. And it might be have nothing to do with what you're eating, Felicity, and just how deep you're going on these long rides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Let's go into some rapid fire from Kai. He's basically asking what he says. It would be nice if you could discuss the positioning of mountain bikes versus road bikes and like what your position would be. What are the main differences and similarities? And should you try and mimic a road position on the mountain bike and vice versa? How big of an impact does Q Factor really have on the position for both bikes? So he said he's found the perfect position he feels on both bikes, but he doesn't know. So I did a race recently, and I didn't have a back camera on my bike because I'm trying to get a new seat post with a zero offset so I can mount it, because I have my saddle on my road bike trying to match where my saddle is on my mountain bike, because the mountain bike is my main goal. So mm-hmm. you should just try to emulate it. Generally, what you'll find with modern mountain bikes now is that modern mountain bikes have a longer distance between the bottom bracket and the head tube. It's being stretched out there. And then as a result, also then in addition to this, they're making the seat sit further forward in relation to the bottom bracket. The seat tube angle is more steep. So that basically means that on a road bike, if you're trying to match it to a mountain bike, that means you're probably going to have to push your saddle really far forward. Maybe you'll get a longer stem, but that's usually where you'll end up doing it. I'm absolutely in favor of trying to match your bikes. You can't match like a TT bike. That's obviously something that's very different. But a road bike, a gravel bike, and a mountain bike, if you have one priority, absolutely try to shift things so that everything matches one bike. But if not, you can have variations and it's not going to be the end of the world. Like, you know, my saddle on my road bike still, even where it is, it's a centimeter further behind my, or it's a centimeter further back than it is on my mountain bike. And my reach is a little bit longer on my road bike when I'm in the hoods, right? But it's fine. It's not like I can't put out power there. And Q Factor, some people like Alex Wilde said that it was a huge impact to him. Like he could not put out the same power. So he went through the whole process of pedal spindles and cranks and adjusting lots of things. But for me, my Q Factor is a little bit different and it's fine. It doesn't mess me up. I don't know.
John, when you mean say the same, you mean the saddle to bottom bracket position, right? Because obviously the mountain bike, your hip angle is going to be way higher up. Your arms are wider. Everything else kind of changes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the main point. So there's three main points that you want to look at: where your bottom bracket is, because you can't change that. If you do, you've broken your frame. So you can't change where your bottom bracket is. That's where that is. And then your saddle, you can change, and your hand, where your hands are, you can change. Just think of those like three quadrants, right? And if you can try to line those three points up in space, then you'll be better off. So but that's, I mean, what I try to do.
On a road bike though, you're much more aggressive than a mountain bike.
Yeah. So my road bike is it's not as much as maybe you'd think, but yeah, my road bike is more aggressive. I only have one small spacer underneath the head, underneath the stem. On my mountain bike, it's fully
subtle flex.
So
yeah, one small. There's no spacers, pretty much. That's what we talk about it. Not like it's 1 centimeter difference. It's just no spacers. So you know, I ride with no spacers. Now, on your TT bike, how many spacers do you have, John? Do you have in your TT bike, John?
A really big one, actually, now, because Ryan Standish has it. So, but we all know what's happening when I get that bike back.
No spacers.
No spacers.
You need a shirt that says no spacers. Just to wear.
Just come
before
to me for
bike
your bike
race.
Fit for your bike fit consulting. I'll just take all your spacers out and slam your stem and
done. John, yeah. You said something interesting because in my Venge, so I have with the C tube angle, it is less steep, and because my saddle is so high, it puts my saddle pretty far back by my bottom bracket. And on the Epic, it is less steep. And I actually have that one pushed forward. And so basically on my mountain bike, my saddle is much closer to the bottom bracket than the Venge is. Mm-hmm. Did you get a seat post for the Venge that has a zero offset that use and then have put my saddle more like the Epic?
Do you want one as well? I can get you one ordered as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And I just need an extra long one.
Yeah. Bike manufacturers quit making setback seat posts. They're the worst. So
I love them.
I think it matters with how much post you're showing and the seat tube angle. Cause that's a huge difference.
Nate, your seat tube angle is profoundly impactful because you have such long legs, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have relatively short legs, your seat tube angle doesn't affect you as much. So
yeah.
For you, you're really far behind your bottom bracket. It makes your bike handle totally differently.
Based on how far your seat tube angle is, it's like, I want to say 3 inches, maybe like the difference in where you could put your saddle, in accordance to your bottom bracket. And that it's just, I almost need a forward offset on my road bike in order to get it close to where the Epic is.
Hmm. Yeah. With how long your legs are. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think everybody has something where they're a little bit more sensitive. Like for me, my sensitivity is in my knees. My back is solid. So my reach can be off by 2 or 3 centimeters, reach being the distance between the saddle and the handlebars, and the stack height on the front can be up or down a couple centimeters. And that's not going to bother me as long as my saddle setback relative to the bottom bracket is solid. So I can deal with changing hip angle, changing reach, stack. All of that is fine for me because my back is not as sensitive as my knees. Whereas some other people might say, okay, my back is the really sensitive point. My knees, I think probably Alex is probably not in this category where he's sensitive to the Q factor, but everybody's body is a little bit different. So you might have a sensitive point where, okay, as long as this one measurement is solid, these others can fudge a little bit and be okay. So that's something to be aware of in yourself. So if there's some aspect of your fit that is a little bit more sensitive than others, and that's something you want to use as an anchor point, and then other things can adjust. So between my road bike and my mountain bike, I'm as long as my saddle setback is solid, so saddle height and setback are good, then I feel fine being flexible in terms of the reach and the stack height and those differences.
Mine is the saddle height that mm-hmm. I am so sensitive to that, and I traveling and all that sort of stuff. And I mentioned this before, but I'll say it again. I have the Abbey bike tools like saddle position thing. Mm-hmm. If you Google that, it'll come up.
Yeah.
And it's a piece of metal and it's $100. And you're like, crazy. Why would I ever do that? But I use that thing. It's like value versus the cost of it. Mm-hmm. I use that thing all the time. I travel with it in the bike bag. Two, it's because the way that it's angled, if you have a TT bike or the way that it's made, it's smart where you can really figure out if you have how far back your tip of your saddle is from your bottom bracket, or if mm-hmm. it's just that like 5 centimeter rule, mm-hmm. I can do the angle. I put my cell phone on it and get the angle of my saddle really easily. And, I can get it down to like the millimeter every time. If you got to make sure that when you put it on your saddle to line it up, it's got to be in the middle because any left or right motion, not motion, but if you put on left or right at all, that will also change it. But I can get down to the millimeter between bikes. And then what I do is I use a white, it's almost like a whiteout pen, but it's like a paint pen. Mm-hmm. a paint pen. And I mark it, John, plug your ears. I mark my my seat post where that is, but then I take a picture of it because where that is,
yeah,
when you put it in, you're like,
yeah,
it's not exactly flush. And so when I go and travel, as I've taken my seat post out, I look at the picture and look at where the paint is and get it just right. And unless I have the thing once,
yeah.
Before we had somebody take pictures of my bike here and he wiped off all my paint pen marks. And I was just on the TT bike and I had a few on there because I was trying different positions and I was like, I flipped out. I was like, what are you doing? Why would you not ask me on that? He's a cyclist too. He should know better than to wipe off marks of like where your saddle is.
You destroyed the blueprints.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
That's soul crushing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. That was too upset for that. But anyways.
Yeah. Please, Pete.
I was going to say one pro tip, use the same. If you can use the same saddle on all your bikes. As soon as I did that, you can tell when something's off in like in a half a second. You sit on and the saddle's not right. And the two data points from the nose of your saddle to your bottom bracket, you can tell almost instantly. And so I just run the same saddle on all my bikes and you can tell right away whether something feels exactly as it should or it feels wrong. Because it's the familiar anchor point that you want to use anyways.
Agreed. So make it match. Pay attention to the 3 points of your bottom bracket, your saddle, and where your hands are. Those are the 3 points. And then, make it match. From Josh, and we'll actually do this one rapid fire. While training indoors, do you wear gloves?
No.
I've seen this, and I think it's when people are like particularly sweating a lot. It helps, I think, is why they would use them. Amber, do you use gloves inside?
I do. No, not inside.
Oh, Amber's muted. But
sorry. No, I don't use them inside. I use them outside mostly for sun protection.
Yeah. And I just, if I'm sweating a lot and I'm doing a ride without fans on or for one reason or another, I just have like a hand towel and that usually soaks up all the sweat. So
Pete and John don't wear gloves outside either. So
correct.
I do wear gloves outside actually.
So, on the road?
Yeah. This
transition.
I'm just terrified of destroying my hands. You know, if something like think of like a silly fall, it could be like, you're fine. Yeah. Or it could be like, yeah, I can't train for 3 weeks because my hands are just, there's no skin left.
So I literally told you this stuff in Hawaii, that exact same thing. And you said, yes, but the road feel is so much better. Do you ever this?
It's true. Like it does. I do feel worse when I wear gloves, but I bet I would feel a lot worse and I don't have skin on my hands. So
what gloves are you using?
I'm still in the hunt for like my favorite gloves, but they're ones that's a moto brand called Fast House. I hate stretchy gloves, like gloves that are excessively stretchy on the back that allow shifting around because then it introduces like a slip plane in between your hand and your bars. Mm-hmm. So then you end up gripping way harder than you need to, even on the road. Like you end up gripping a lot harder than you need to, and I just don't like that. So these ones are kind of like, they don't have any padding or anything else. I don't know. Don't ask me what gloves I use. I'm trying to figure out which ones are best. While training indoors, bib straps over the shoulders or not? Always over the shoulders for me.
Tarzan over the shoulders. So both bib straps on one side.
That's amazing.
You post on Instagram?
Please do. Yeah, I do because if you don't put your bib straps on, then your bibs can shift. And I don't want any shifting going on. The bib should be one with the body. So you don't want slip plane again.
And right now I need them to just hold my belly in.
Okay. During individual leg training, where do you put the resting leg? Leave it hanging on the side, tippy toe on the floor, leave it clipped in, but tell it to not have any force while the other's one works.
Am I back?
What do you do?
You're back. You're back.
Phew. That was tough. That was a rough 15 seconds.
You scared us.
So when you do one-legged drills, where do you put your leg, everyone? John, go.
I awkwardly hang it and it flies all over the place because I'm on the rollers. Things get wild.
Pete?
That does sound wild.
Yeah, on the rollers, it's really hard. I just sort of awkwardly hang it. But if I'm on the trainer, you can put your foot back and kind of like put your toe on the kind of two anchor points for your rear axle on the trainer. And it works pretty well. And it feels like you're not compromising your position. That's what I try.
Amber?
I just leave mine clipped in and I tell it not to work. And I like that because it counterweights a little bit.
That's amazing.
I do.
Not loud. Don't work.
Don't work. Stop. I mean,
doesn't everybody tell their legs to shut up? No, I'm just kidding. No. Like I just leave it in and then and like deactivate it basically. But I like having the counterweight so that over the top of the pedal stroke, I'm not straining that hip flexor too much. So I like it for the mechanical benefit of it. And I think that the benefit of the isolated leg drills is really the focus on form. So as long as you're being really focused, I think you still get as much out of them. So my two cents.
Amber, you get a 10 out of 10 on that answer.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. I don't do them.
then there's that.
That works well. Okay. This next one, he says, Betsy, she says, I'm not in the adaptive training beta yet. I'm feeling overwhelmed between all the choices, training plan, train now, looking up workouts based on the new progression levels. Do you have a rank of what is ideal and when these other things should be used? I feel like I'm getting a bit lost in all the options and I just want this, and she mentions there, she says, and she just wants to be able to know what to do. So Nate, what would you say on this one?
Betsy, if you are training for a peak event, use Plan Builder to give you a training plan. If you are just training for general fitness with no specific event, use Train Now. Boom. That's all you got to do.
Yep.
That's it. There we go. Chris says, outside trainer road workouts for on a mountain bike. Do you use different setup of wheels and tires for these? Or should you try to emulate your race setup? I usually end up doing outside on the road and bike paths. I call them burner tires. They're just tires that have tire plugs in them, or they're older tires that I've taken off for a race. And I use those and I put those on. So then I also someday, if I do Leadville or something like that again, I'll have some amazingly fast tires because they'll have zero knobs in the center and just worn down to slicks. And I might get flats, but who knows? I'm just telling myself that's a side benefit.
But do you have two wheel sets for this? Because changing...
No, it's a pain. I don't have wheel sets because buying wheel sets in 2021 is a challenge. So it's like, I can't find any like cheap, just aluminum wheel sets that are 29 inch that I could just use. So it's a pain. I have tire changing ahead of me and it's even more of a pain with tire inserts. My fingers are already hurting thinking about it. So, but yeah, that's what I do. Okay. Last question is going to be from Ben and we'll try to get through this one pretty quick. Cause Pete's going to turn into a pumpkin if we don't hurry up. So,
we got some time.
Ben says, yeah,
I have to pee too.
Okay. Nate, you're free to just do as you need. This is a long question
I'll be
to
back.
Read out. So, Ben says, big fan of the podcast, 5 stars, really hoping to be added to the adaptive training beta soon. And Ben mentions, I didn't PM Jonathan on Instagram. So hopefully that gets me bonus points. Ben, I wish I could give you 1,000 points cause I would. But I can't do that just as I can't let anybody into the beta. So, but just the same, we are in all, you know, joking around, happy to see you all on Instagram and follow us all there. It's fun to see you all. So, Ben says, so I'm currently training for Ironman Texas, which has been pushed back to October 7th, and I get a lottery spot for the Escape from Alcatraz triathlon in August out in San Francisco. One quick thing that I'm just thinking about, since Ironman Texas has been pushed back to October 7th and Kona is right around then, I bet we're going to see an interesting field at Ironman Texas because since it's close to Kona, you know. Anyways, okay, so Escape from Alcatraz, back to that. Escape isn't a standard distance triathlon as it is a 1.5 mile swim, an 18 mile bike, and an 8 mile run. So pretty short bike course.
Yeah.
I currently have the event set as an Olympic distance try as it is the closest distance, but I'm curious if I would be better suited setting it up as something different as I'm living in Houston, which is flat, flat, flat. And the Escape course has 1,500 feet of elevation gain in that 18 mile course. I want to make sure that I'm ready for those climbs. So should I be training for a different event type to make sure I'm ready for the climbs? Or is a long course try plan that I'm doing already going to set me up the best? Thanks for all you do. Hopefully my question is useful for others and can get in the line early enough, adjusting my training if needed. So this is a great question because it applies to more than just Escape from Alcatraz. This one applies to a lot of us. We got a lot of questions that are really similar to this about people lining up for events that are coming up in their calendar. So here's what I would recommend in this case, and just like a good point of knowledge to keep in mind. Number one, if you have an event that has totally different circumstances than what you're used to, the elevation profile does not force you to ride it entirely differently. you have the choice to pace that elevation profile how you choose to. And I think that that's a very big thing to keep in mind. So if you're used to flat, but you have something that's going to be climbing and rolling hills, that doesn't mean that you have to be surging and coasting and surging and coasting, and vice versa as well. If you're used to just constantly undulating terrain and you have a really flat thing, it doesn't mean that you're going to be a fish out of water. Remember, you're training your body to be able to put out power, and you'll be able to put out that power for specific times. Pete, what thoughts do you have on this sort of pacing over the undulating terrain, that sort of a thing?
Yeah, I think the pacing over undulations is kind of my MO because I can't go uphill very fast and I can go downhill pretty fast. So it's actually pretty similar. It's all about putting out sustained power no matter the grade. And I think this course is hilly enough that you won't be forced into having to do anything out of your comfort zone. And it's only 18 miles. So you're going to be going pretty fast. Like race pace is going to be strong. So I don't think you even have to worry that the hills are going to change the way that you're able to pace this. So it'll feel just like the efforts you've been putting out in Texas, luckily.
Nate, have you done this race?
Yeah. Sorry, Pete. I have done this race.
I'm glad we disagreed today. That makes for good podcasting.
It does. Who's going to win, though, between you and Chad and me and Sophia? That's probably a better question. Let's get some beef. Gosh.
I think we're going to. I mean, I'm not really worried, honestly.
How many Olympians are on your team?
Just checking. Zero, luckily.
Okay, cool.
I think that's better. Denominator, Nate. It's the lowest common denominator. So
I know.
Because Sophia cannot finish far ahead of you. She has to finish what? Within 30 seconds or 15 seconds or something of you?
We have to be within a minute of ourselves the whole time, but she can just push me all the time. That's fine.
Sophia can't wait. She's super excited.
This race, you start off on this huge barge thing next to Alcatraz. You're not actually on Alcatraz. And they have you line up, and there's all these, it's really super early, and you're cold, and you're in a wetsuit. If you've ever been to San Francisco, the bay is not warm at all, the weather. And people wear, like, stuff on their head and, like, booties. Booties make you a lot slower, but stuff like that to try to be warm. And then when you jump off, there's just all these people jumping off, like a boat, like it's the Titanic, and you jump in though, and someone's going to jump on top of you. So you have to jump in, and you can't just, like, you get shocked with the water. You got to start swimming right away. And they tell you, they say, this isn't even answering the question, but it's kind of interesting. They say, okay, how long do you think it's going to take you to swim 1.5 miles. And you're like, I don't know. And they say, aim for these different landmarks as you swim, because the current, based on where the current is, or the tide, and it will, I guess the current, because you're not aiming anywhere close to where you think you're swimming. You're aiming, like, way up, I think, to the right, and then you kind of drift back down. But that can be, like, I don't know how far. I've never swam 1.5 miles at a time. How long it is.
Sharks in the bay?
Well, there are great whites, and you get lined by all of these boats. But
Funny you say that, Jonathan.
The scary thing is,
sharks.
There is a seal there named Nibbles, and Nibbles takes Nibbles out of people pretty often. At least you can Google Nibbles. I think Nibbles the seal or sea lion. I forget. But
Ben,
in
why are
San Francisco
you doing this
Bay,
race? This race sounds terrible.
As far as I know, Nibbles hasn't hit somebody from. In this race, but you know, people swim that swim, like, I think every day, and without a wetsuit, so you'll be fine. And then you get there. Here's the brutal part. When I did it, you then had to run a mile in your wetsuit or take off your wetsuit to transition to T1, like barefoot. So you could, like, leave shoes or something there, or Crocs, but your feet are all, it's kind of hard. And then you start the bike and you go, and it is,
hold on. We can't go past this. You just said leave Crocs for your running transition.
Yeah. Dude, you think that's not.
No, just like, why not running shoes? Why Crocs. Aren't they Crocs?
It's the speed, and with your feet being so wet and no socks and getting them off fast, a tight Croc with the thing on the back actually works pretty good for just a mile.
Race Crocs.
This is amazing.
I think, you know what, I wonderful. Think I said this too, because I didn't bring shoes for this, and somebody else gave me Crocs to use for that part. So I had somebody else's Crocs. And those Crocs worked pretty well.
Just bolt some SPD cleats on there and you're set. You just use those on the bike too. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you start going, and there's actually a picture of me. It's on my Facebook, but it is so steep that I had to be out of the saddle, like flexing on my bars in my TT bike. And I think I had a compact. I wasn't super fit back then, maybe 260 FTP for my size, but it's definitely not a, oh, I can just spin up, unless maybe nowadays the gearing's better. This was like in 2007 or something, but there's definitely climbs that are steep enough that if you don't have the gearing, you're going to have to go above what your pacing plan is. But then there's downhills that are steep enough that you can't pedal, or you're not going to be an aero. I remember there was a, what is his name? Andy Potts. Is that his name? Yep. He's won that race a ton of times. And I saw him flying down on a descent in like 50-11 or something like that, you know, going really fast in aero bars. That's probably not common, but there are some really steep stuff. So my recommendation is, have the gearing, of course. I wouldn't have like a standard up front unless you are like a 5 watt per kilo person. And then just do what you can. You're going to probably go above your pacing plan on the climbs, and you're going to make up. You're probably going to be fine. If you're doing intervals a lot of time, if you think you're going to hit whatever you're not going to be able to be smooth the whole time on this course. And maybe they've changed the course since I've done it. I'm not sure. You can always plop it into best bike split, and then we'll really tell you about what to do. That's probably the best advice. Mm-hmm. And then totally do the Olympic plan though. Raising the way the Olympic plan is built too. I'm almost positive you go over threshold a bunch, and then, mm-hmm. And then you will, for the distance of this, it's great. And then the run is, see the run too, they make you run on the beach. And when you go down to the beach, yeah, running on the beach, what you do is you run really close to the water though, because that's, if you're running on the beach, you want to be almost in the water if you can be without getting your feet wet, because that is where the hard sand is, and it's way easier to run there. And then you have to though, you can run up this thing called the ladder or the steps. I forget the name of it. It's an extremely long and steep staircase after you've done all this. And there's another picture of me. I'm like, you can like barely, I should probably put these on Instagram, but I'm just barely making it up there. And kind of like, it's that thing where you're going up steps and you're like pushing your leg. Like every step you're like pushing your leg to try to get up because you're exhausted, man. Right? So you've ran, this is at the very end of the run too. You've probably run like 6 miles, like a 10K, as hard as you can. And then you have to go up the stairs. So.
Jeez.
But it's super fun. It's probably one of my favorite craft ones. And it's one of those bucket list things. It's cool to say you've swam from Alcatraz. It's just a nice, neat thing. And I'm glad I did it. And I'd do it again.
Wow. Fair enough. That event does not sound fun to me, but
it's so fun. We should do it.
You really sold it. Sold it.
If you give me transition Crocs, I'm in. So
I haven't seen Nibbles in a while, so
so we're good. I want to talk generally about this though, because this is a situation a lot of people are coming up against. Like my A event just has totally different terrain for what I'm prepping for, and I think it is important to talk about, because you can like be very perfect in your training and get everything done, but. If you live in Montana and you're racing in Cozumel down in Mexico, that if you don't prepare for that heat and humidity, it's going to, no matter how great your preparation is, you're really hindering your ability to execute, right? Mm-hmm. And the same could be said if it's like, you know, elevation is a lot tougher to counter for if you live at flat elevation going up to high, but still you can do certain things to be able to mitigate that. But let's just talk about that really quick. And I think that there are some things that you can focus on, some things that like you kind of just have to ignore. Nate,
I have opinions. Yeah. I think triathlon, it is, I think it's actually harder for a person in a hilly area to go race on a flat course, because mm-hmm. for the half and Ironman distance to be in aero for that whole time is so like, it's its own thing, and then your neck and your shoulders really hurt, where when you are climbing you can get in and out of saddle, you sit up, and it's much more variable. That's why when we do an Ironman one day, I actually want to pick something where it's not totally flat, because we can't do that here, stay, you know, aero for, you know, 5 hours for us and 6 hours for Chad. It's going to be super duper hard to do that.
Nice. That was a good little thing.
Nice. He doesn't listen, so I can say whatever I want. And then the heat, that's the other one that kills people. It's easier to go cold because you just wear clothes, but mm-hmm. the heat mm-hmm. That's probably the worst, is going to heat. And then humidity is a aspect of the heat and just makes it hotter. that is, we've talked about it a bunch. You got to do sauna training. I mean, you got to sit in the sauna if you can. If you could ride some of the sauna, that would be great. Or in the bathroom with the shower on. But that is killer. And then elevation is the last that hits everyone the same. That's where you either go right before or take 3 weeks, supposedly. There's some mixed stuff on that, mixed reports. Or do crazy with like elevation tents and all that. But that's...
Yeah.
It's probably, I don't know. I feel like probably the heat one is the biggest one that you can actually overcome and have a way big performance than just a shattered day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing I want to mention, and just like a vote for indoor training, if you live in a hilly area and you have a full Ironman or any sort of race where it's like really steady, that's one of the huge benefits of being on the trainer, being able to be in position or keep steady power for as long as you need to. It's just, it pays huge dividends. Any other thoughts on this, Amber, about
you can do the inverse. If you're in a flat area and you know that you're going to be going someplace like a race like this, where there are going to be some steep kind of punchy parts of the climb, a couple things. Mix up your cadence when you're doing steady state efforts on the trainer. So you can do those efforts at maybe a cadence of 75 or 70 instead of a cadence of 80, 85. And then you can also do some of those efforts standing. So mixing up your cadence and your position on the bike, because like Nate was saying, you might need to be standing to leverage the frame on some of the steeper stuff. And then training that kind of muscular endurance and that mechanical motor pattern can be really helpful too. And mentally, you feel mentally more prepared. And then two other things on that. One is gearing. I think Pete mentioned this, hugely important. That can save you. So, you know, talk to other people who've done the race and find out what would be helpful, because that can help even that out a little bit for you or make it considerably worse depending on the situation. Yes. And then if there are lots of ups and downs and you're on a bike with aero bars, the technical aspect of that is going to come in handy or is going to become very important. So if you are not used to being in the aero bars going down steep hills, don't try it in the race. Go for stability over aero every time, because when you're in control, you'll be willing to go at higher speed. You'll be safer. And you'll end up making more time than you would trying to stay in the aero bars on a section where you really don't feel comfortable and you're not in control. So just the technique aspect, the gearing, and then, you know, playing around with your cadence when you're doing steady state efforts where you are now can really go a long way.
Don't ever be in the aero bars on descents in you triathlon people. And because the race is packed with people, if you are a TT-er and you're in a Tour de France and you're by yourself, even those guys, you see them. They come out of the aero bars. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
And there are certain people that do it. You can just not react. And because of triathlon, it is like it's a loose peloton, right? And people are moving. One person kind of drifts and then someone's passing. That's where the crashes happen, right? Mm-hmm. It's two people passing at once. And one person's coming faster on the outside. And the person that's passing the first person doesn't realize it. If you're in your aero bars, you're going to have a bad, bad, bad time. Mm-hmm. And even if you think you're by yourself, you're not looking back while you're descending in the aero bar. Someone else could be coming up on you faster. Just please don't do it in any race.
One easy thing to remember with that is if you're braking, remember that's a whole lot more detrimental to your speed than being in the aero bars. So that, or being like, you know, being out of your aero positions. So in other words, if you're using your brakes, there's no reason to try to be aerodynamic on top of that. That's not giving you any benefit, right?
Yeah.
So
pretty much if you're pedaling and there's no turns, you can be in the aero bars.
Sure, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you're Jeff Kabush, does not like aero bars. but one thing that does like suspension forks on a gravel bike. The next thing I wanted to add with this is technicality. If you show up to a race and you have, it's like way more technical than what you're used to riding. So crits, mountain bikes, road races, courses with seals that bite you, all that stuff. Whatever you have, if it's more technical, you can find opportunities to try to work on your skill beforehand. Just try to, because that's one thing where, like elevation, you can't do much unless you can afford like a tent and to be able to sleep in an elevation tent or somehow go to the race long beforehand. You can't do much. But technicality, you can improve yourself. It doesn't mean that you're going to be as good as some sort of high mark, you know, some athlete that's very technically sound, but you can improve. And that's one thing that I think can lower your cognitive load, particularly when you have a race that's so set on pacing. So if you have like for triathlon in particular, if your mind is just, you know, scrambled eggs up there because you're terrified of the technical aspects of the course that you're riding on, it's going to make it really hard for you to focus on holding your pace because you're, that's so all consuming. Yeah. So if you can get to the point where you are putting more time in on those technical skills, it can just really go a long way. And you can do that through a lot of different ways. A parking lot drill has amazing application to being out on the road in terms of making you more comfortable, even though it's not exactly the same. So that's one thing that I would say. If you have an event coming up and it is more technical, you can prep for that. Try to figure those things out beforehand.
If you Google SF Bay Nibbles the Seal, the first article is Rogue Elephant Seal Goes on Rampage. But this is
it's amazing.
This is 2007 though, so this seal's probably, I don't know how long. I mean, do seals, maybe they're really good at it now. Who knows? Like, I don't know how long seals. Let's see. I'm going to Google it. Seals. keep
talking. I'm glad we're solving the important problems. The other thing that I want to mention, though, that Nate said on the cold, like a lot of people ask, like, am I going to get a benefit because I'm used to it? But in terms of cold, yes, you can put layers on. You can manage all of that. But a lot of that ends up coming down to how a person manages their mental space as well. Cold throws you out of your comfort zone. And if you're out of your comfort zone because of something like that, it can be tough. So yeah, I mean, familiarizing yourself with it, if you're able to, I don't know if anybody has a giant freezer that is safe to ride in, doesn't really sound safe, but if you're able to, sure, it probably will help you get used to things, but no physical adaptation is going to be there.
More than 30 years. So Nibbles could be around
alive
still.
And well.
Yep, yes. Still there, nibbling.
So the question is, how do you simulate the nibbling when you're training open water swimming?
Get a dog.
Yeah, exactly. Find that one dog on the group ride and just ride back and forth right by it. This has been a fun episode. Thanks, y'all for doing this one. And thanks everybody for tuning in. If you're watching on YouTube, if you haven't already, give it a thumbs up. You can hit the like button. Looks like a thumb. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel so you don't miss episodes. You can hit the notification bell so then you get prompted when we post things because we post things regularly and they all are designed to make you faster. And you can subscribe to this podcast on Spotify or whatever app you're using and share it with other people. The sharing of the app is probably one of the best things you can do. Stay tuned to trainerroad.com. We'll have more updates coming. Amber's team is working super hard on some updates right now. The whole team is working hard on stuff, but we're excited to release some things in the future for you guys. So stay tuned. Go to trainerroad.com/AT and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.